Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced by WEKU and Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. This week, a new report showing half of rural counties gaining population, half losing people. We'll hear about efforts to keep the Kentucky River flowing clean, Wes Brown on his award-winning crime novel, They All Fall the Same, and a heads up about the next international artist Green Room Exchange is bringing to Lexington. First, those polls we always hear about. How do they work, and how should we read them? Here's Carolyn DuPont, host of our series Civics, Civility, and the Path to a Shared American Future.
My guest today is Elliot Morris, who is a data-driven journalist, and he writes the Substack Strength in Numbers. Welcome back to the program, Elliot.
Well, I was really excited to be asked back. Thanks so much for having me.
You know, the reason that I ask you to come again is because of an article you published in Strength in Numbers on March 3rd, and you share polling that you conducted that demonstrates that people seem to hold and often give contradictory answers on important policy questions. Polling seems like it's just about numbers and it's dry, but there's actually a lot of our humanity that shows up in well-done polling.
Right.
Can you take us through those results that you talked about in that March 3rd article?
Right. One of the reasons I love polling is it's just another way to talk to people, and this is a good reminder of that. The core finding from our little investigation is that the words that you use in a poll question can very often change the results that you get. This is something that we call framing, sometimes called priming for those polling nerds out there. So for example, when we asked Americans if they supported a, quote, path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants, we got 76% of adults saying yes to that question. Mm. We didn't provide many specifics, so this was somewhat left up to the imagination of the reader. We did specify that this was for people who had been here a long time and that had paid taxes, for example, but this isn't a test of an actual policy preference. It's just for illustrative purposes. But we find only 45% of Americans say they would support amnesty for essentially the same people who had been here for some time. So that's a roughly 30 percentage point swing in how we think of the American people as supportive of this general policy, which is undocumented immigrants who meet some criteria would be allowed to stay, based on just the question wording of our survey. And this applies to a lot of other policies as well. We also tested support for whether or not parents could pursue doctor-recommended treatment for their children transitioning. You know, no surgery, but gender-affirming care in general. So, you know, puberty blockers, et cetera, hormone blockers. And there was a 20 percentage point gap from whether or not someone would support this if you specified that the treatment was recommended by their doctor and in collaboration with their parents. So the point here is that how you frame things impacts poll results in general. And this is important to take into account in our journalism about polling.
So why is it? What is happening there? You know, the word amnesty does hit me differently than citizenship. And so talk about that a little bit.
Well, framing is the idea that specific words that you put in front of someone activates a different part of their brain, different considerations going on in their brain as they're thinking about what to reply to you with. So the political scientist John Zoller has a model for this called the receive-accept sample model, where you might receive information about the world. In this case, you know, there's people here without, you know, authorization to be here, and some of them pay taxes and have been here for a very long time. Whether or not they take that information is whether or not they're accepting it. And then if I, as a pollster, am asking them to give me back some information about how they're feeling about undocumented immigrants, that sampling process, RAS, is dependent on what words I'm priming them with. So amnesty, in this case, might activate a sort of rule of law part of your brain. Someone broke the rules and now we're giving them amnesty for it, forgiveness for breaking the rules. Whereas path to citizenship might be activating like the fairness part of your brain, just spitballing here. So that could explain those differences. And, you know, on the trans rights question, gender affirming care for minors, that's what we asked, does sound awfully culture war-y, right? People are primed a certain way to think about that by their partisanship, which we'll talk about. Whereas parental rights to pursue doctor recommended treatment, which is essentially the same policy, given gender affirming care for minors doesn't typically happen without parental and parents and doctors ascending to it, activates a sort of like family deference. I don't know, deference to medical professionals as well. So the way that we ask people questions impacts how they respond because it's activating different parts of their brains. Mm. And so when we as pollsters are asking questions, we're really careful to think about the parts of the brain that we're activating when we're asking people questions. Mm-hmm. And this is important for people who consume polls, because you might often see a result that's very surprising or very controversial or really attention grabbing. And it's important to look at the question. It's especially important for the reporter of the survey to look at the question that was asked to make sure there's not any undue priming going on.
Yeah, and it just moves me to think about how careful we as the public, when we're reading about a poll said this or a poll said that, how careful we need to be about understanding what that can mean. What that moved me to think about is that people have not only contradictory opinions, but conflicting values often come into play on a political question. And so, you know, on the one hand, I think someone could naively say, well, you know, people are hypocrites, but maybe that's really not what's going on. It's that I feel conflicted about, say, gender-affirming care for minors, because nobody wants a young person to make a decision that's life-altering before they're prepared to do it. At the same time, people want to be, I think, compassionate and understanding. And so those values seem to conflict with one another. And I really like the way you put this. You said the median voter is neither liberal nor conservative, but both and neither, depending on the words you put in front of them. So what I'm wondering is, are most of us in our political affiliations, are we just ignoring those conflicts or sort of preemptorily resolving those conflicts that actually lie more deeply under those questions when we say, you know, we're a Republican or we're a Democrat?
I think this is a really good question. And it'll be a reminder to the listeners that the hardest thing a pollster does is select their question wording, because we contain so many conflicting feelings depending on the setting that we're in. And that's just human nature, right? That's the way that our brains are set up. We're not liberal or conservative all the time in every single context. And you as a person, if I'm sitting at the bar across from you and I'm talking to you about politics, first, sorry for ruining your night, but second, depending on the context of the news, you might feel differently. And that's just the right way to think about this, as opposed to thinking that everyone is solidly liberal or solidly conservative on every matter of politics. And you know what? We also found that a lot of people conflicted or had contradictory beliefs based on whether or not they would say they don't know how they feel about a certain policy. So people would express a liberal opinion on amnesty, path to citizenship, infrastructure spending, you know, one of the versions of the transgender policy wordings, but then say they don't know how they feel about the other transgender policy wording. They just refused to answer that question, or maybe they were genuinely unsure about that as well. And that goes to a broader point that I've been writing about on my Substack and is uncovered a little bit in my book, which is a lot of people just don't really have firm opinions about politics. And when we ask them, sometimes they're randomly picking responses, but for the most part, their responses, their feelings are evoked based off of the context of the question. So, you know, I hate to be a little wishy-washy here, but sometimes the values that we have are dependent on the context in which we're holding those values.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're getting here at a gray area, very human area, that exist in this world when we're asked to think about politics as black and white, as right and left. And a lot of what you're saying, I think, connects very well to Hiram Lewis's book, The Myth of Left and Right, where he argues that, you know, that's not really our dividing line, even though we can conceive of it that way. And so that's kind of where I wanted to go next, because what is it that makes some of us think we are liberal or conservative? What is it that makes some of us think we are Republican or Democrat when, in fact, we have so much overlap, so much ambiguity, so many inner conflicts or inner contradictions on issues?
If the question is, why do so many of us think we are left-leaning or right-leaning, I think part of the answer is media coverage of the average person. Now, I used to work for a large network media TV company, so I've seen this up close and personal. And there's just a temptation when you are narrating about people to tell nice, neat stories.
Oh, yes.
And sometimes the way we talk about these nice, neat stories is demographic or cultural. These are white Americans or black Americans. These are Americans from, you know, the South, where I'm from, or from the Northeast. And often the other dividing line we settle into, because it's easy, it's neat, it's convenient, is party affiliation. You're a Republican, or you're a Democrat, or your ideology. You're liberal and you're conservative. And the media thinks in these terms because they're very educated, so they understand them. And because of these neat heuristics for their coverage of politics. And because, in my experience, they don't spend a whole lot of time with members of the other side of the aisle, or just with everyday people who don't spend all day thinking about politics. Mm-hmm. And so don't think with their labels attached to them as well. I did this survey last year where I asked Americans to tell us what they wanted their ideal political party to believe. If your political party could fight for one thing, what would it be? And for the most part, Americans did not give ideological responses to that question. They said, you know, I want a party that makes the life for an everyday American better, or lowers the cost of healthcare, or makes groceries more affordable. And, you know, while with our partisan hats on, we might think a certain side of the aisle is better at doing those things, they are not ideological in the same way, you know, an answer such as, I want MAGA to win every race, or I want Democrats to win the upcoming governor election, would be considered partisan. So we only found that about 25% of the public was reliably right-leaning, and about 25% was reliably left-leaning. The rest of us were concerned about conditions and about the failures of economic and political systems to deliver those conditions. So we are really united, in other words, as Americans, in our general concern for each other, and that is reassuring.
It's incredibly reassuring, and it's incredibly hopeful, but at the same time, it's mystifying, because I've often thought about our polarization today and, you know, what's at the core of it. And as a historian, you know, I think back to the Civil War, when the issue was pretty clear. And so that one is easy to explain. But if you're trying to explain today's partisanship, which is so intense and acrimonious, and you try to figure out what's at the core of it, it's really, really hard for me anyway to identify that. And it begs all kinds of questions. You know, you were just sort of alluding to a sort of top-down narrative or a top-down driver. And I think that the way that we think about how we arrive at our political convictions, you know, we think we have a prior commitment to certain values or ideals, and that we choose the party that seems to embrace those. But the way you just described it doesn't suggest that that's necessarily the case, that somehow somebody is giving us frameworks for putting names on certain values that get activated.
Right. Well, humans are innately tribal. That's part of our evolutionary biology. And in the modern context, a very obvious tribe for us to affiliate ourselves with is the political tribe, the tribe with loud, what are called opinion leaders or elite leaders, people like, you know, news anchors that are reliably on one side, or your party leaders or opinion columnists in the New York Times or Wall Street Journal, depending on your persuasion, although I guess that distinction is a little less useful now.
Yeah.
But let's not dive into the media criticism there. It's very easy to think of these tribes as fighting for us, depending on our values and where we're from, or what we view as the stakes of conflict in society today. And you give that tribe your vote, which is another psychological way of thinking. You give your trust to that tribe to fight for you. And when that happens, you do, if you are tribal, often take the values and policy positions of that tribe with whatever you are thinking about. But that tribalism, I think in my research, is overstated and really only applies to about half of the public at most. And the rest of us are just living our lives and not thinking about politics and tribes in the way that the media is, and so much of our writing about politics underlines and enforces to some extent.
And it's interesting, just to mention Hiram Lewis again, one of the things that he says is that maybe there's one issue that we find, you know, that's really important to us. And so on that one issue, you know, maybe it's low taxes or abortion or equal rights or something like that, we'll anchor into a party. But then we tend to accept the basket of issues that that party champions. And it's kind of ridiculous to think that, you know, if you support this issue, that you're going to support all the other ones that go with it in that party's basket. It would make more sense that we cross parties in our thinking and in the things that we embrace. I just want to ask you to say a little bit more. You just expressed hopefulness. You know, I think the hopefulness is that we're not irreconcilably divided on issues or ideology. So how do we get our way out of this morass?
Well, I do see hope. I see hope with an asterisk. But the hopeful part is that if Americans are not irreconcilably divided on policy or politics the way that we are led to believe by people who sort us into buckets for ease of coverage, then that opens up a lot of opportunities for collaboration and for improving our conditions of everyday life. But the asterisk is that the people in charge, those opinion leaders, elected leaders in Washington, are incentivized for storytelling reasons or for winning elections reasons, polarization, to sort us and to keep us divided, because it's an easy way for them to win elections, and they have many incentives to do that. So I see hope in that if we as people demand better for our leaders or unite in shared visions of pro-anti-American rather than left and right-leaning, then we can accomplish some great things for the Republic.
Well, you know, on that note, I'm moved to say it's all the more reason to have more conversations like this, and all the more reason for people to go on Substack and find strength in numbers and subscribe to your work. So thank you so much for what you do, and thanks for coming on to talk to us about it.
Well, thanks for having me back. It was a great discussion.
Sarah Millott heads the Rural Index, the Daily Yonder data newsletter, and I asked Sarah to join us to talk us through the findings that went into her article, Rural Counties' New Arrivals Offset Natural Declines for Fifth Consecutive Year. And of course, our particular interest is in what's happening in rural Kentucky. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
You bet. We appreciate you joining us. You write in the article that there are two ways to understand this data. So what do we need to know about those options?
Number one, rural America as an aggregate is growing. That's one way to look at the data. If you look at the whole thing, rural America at large is gaining new residents. But the other way to look at it is that the growth is really uneven across the U.S. Many rural communities are being left behind by that overall trend because of a mix of natural decrease, which happens when deaths outpace births, and out-migration, or when people move away. So we're going in two opposite directions here. Half of rural counties are gaining population, half are losing.
When you look at the economic and the demographic indicators, what stands out to you about rural counties that are doing well versus those that are not doing so well?
Rural communities that rely on a variety of different industries to sustain their local economies are growing. We see growth in communities dependent on manufacturing, farming, on those dependent on the state and federal government. We usually also see lots of growth and other positive economic indicators in rural counties that are dependent on recreation economies. But that's to be expected because these are places that tend to attract affluent residents to begin with. There's a lot of variation on the ground when you zoom into these economies. So even though rural farming communities saw an overall increase in population last year, there were about 200 of these counties that were dependent on farming that saw population decline. That same trend is also true for counties that are dependent on manufacturing. These places saw an aggregate increase in population, but about 170 of those rural counties saw declines. Mining counties, on the other hand, really stand out to me because these communities that are dependent on natural resource extraction and mining are seeing the most drastic declines. In these places, as an aggregate overall, they saw population decrease. And this is because of a mix of out-migration, people moving out, and deaths outnumbering births. So these rural mining towns are seeing both natural decrease and people moving away.
Were you able to use data to see what's happening on an even finer scale?
Yes, I created a county-level population change map that's included in my newsletter, the Rural Index. And you can look at the dailyyonder.com and look up your county in particular. You can zoom in and click on your county and see what other kinds of metrics I've included in the pop-up. You can see exactly how population change has happened in your county. So I look at this at the county level.
Okay. And Sarah has graciously created a Kentucky map. Then we're going to put that on our website. You'll see that at esweku.org so that you can click on it and check your county. And so let's turn to the southeastern Kentucky, if we could, Sarah. First, how do counties in Appalachian Kentucky, those that have traditionally depended on coal mining in particular, how do they show up in this data?
In rural mining-dependent counties in eastern Kentucky, we're seeing overall population decline. Like I said, that's driven both by natural decrease and out-migration. Last year alone, 700 people moved out of eastern Kentucky's rural mining communities. Most of that drop actually happened in Pike County, which saw the greatest decline of population in the entire state of Kentucky and rural counties. 630 people was the population decline in Pike County. Some of that was due to people also dying, not just moving out. So it was a mix of population decline from people moving away and deaths outpacing births in that county.
Many of these counties have been going through this population loss for years. What sort of conditions are left behind when people pull up stakes and head for jobs or easy access to health care and other amenities available in urban areas?
It's kind of hard to tell what comes first, the chicken or the egg question. Do people leave rural counties because of a lack of resources, or does population decline contribute to a lack of resources? I think that it's intuitive that the relationship probably goes both ways in a manner that exacerbates both population decline and resource access. So as people leave, there are fewer people working in essential services, teachers, nurses, librarians, what people are calling brain drain in rural communities. And as those people leave, it creates a depletion and a lack of resources and access for everyone else. And so maybe that means more people leave. So I think this is a kind of circular cycle that kind of feeds into itself.
One often mentioned vision for economic regrowth in the mountains of eastern Kentucky is recreational or ecotourism. But as you reported, many of these counties have been steadily losing their tax bases as people move away. And so if you had to offer an opinion, Sarah, based on your research and data, how likely is it, given those conditions, that the region can succeed in transforming into a go-to destination for tourism and outdoor recreation?
That's a really good question. I'm not sure if I have a good answer to it, but it is something that I do think about a lot. I've reported on a lot of formerly natural resource dependent economies and some of the challenges that they face, like what happens when, you know, the mining company leaves town or the timber industry crashes. Can these places transition to tourism-based economies? It seems that some of them have already. I've spent time in mining communities in northern Idaho that are now largely recreation-based economies. But I guess the bigger question is, do they want to transition? Do they have the public infrastructure to facilitate that transition in a way that's not going to push people out? Do local and state officials value affordable housing for middle and low income families? And are they going to be proactive about making sure that they are just not catering to wealthy newcomers? These are all questions that I ask when I report on tourism economies. And there are a lot of potential advantages to that transition. And then there are a lot of risks as well. In my opinion, it just depends on how it's managed. I'm not exactly sure what makes a community more likely to make that transition, but it's a question worth exploring. I know I just answered your question with a lot of questions. So I guess my answer is I don't know.
Well, that's an honest answer. Just general conversation for generations and the political rhetoric that plays to that, to attitudes in rural counties, is often anti-government. But I see in your reporting that rural counties where the local or federal government drives the economy see population increases. Can you elaborate on that?
State and federal governments are a huge employer in many rural communities. These are communities where a certain share of employment and wages in the county comes from the local public school system, a land grant university, or maybe a national forest or a park or something associated with state or federal government. Rural government dependent counties saw an increase of about 14,000 new residents last year. About 21,000 people moved to those counties last year. Of course, that was offset a little bit by natural decrease, which is the broad trend in rural America that deaths are outpacing births, even in these places where there's population growth overall. I push back on that political rhetoric because local governments and state governments and federal government jobs are really important for rural communities.
While you're with us, Sarah, I'd like to just touch on another of your recent articles for the Daily Yonder because it focuses on something that has, I think, a relationship to what we've been talking about, and that's on the healthcare situation in rural areas. Give us a sense of that picture.
Yes, I recently wrote about how profit margins in rural hospitals are more often operating in the negative compared to urban hospitals. And I wrote about how the Trump administration's cuts to Medicaid will disproportionately hurt rural healthcare systems. Under Trump's orders, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services recently withheld millions of dollars in Medicaid payments to Minnesota. They cited concerns about fraud. And Minnesota said that the Trump administration didn't have adequate reasoning for noncompliance, but a federal judge just blocked the state from being able to fight back. So we'll see how that story develops. But these are the things that I'm keeping an eye on. I'm really curious how federal spending is going to impact people on the ground. You said earlier that in a lot of rural communities, one of the largest employers is the public school system. The healthcare systems in rural communities are also sometimes the largest or one of the largest employers. And the entire community suffers when a hospital shuts down. So if we're cutting Medicaid funding to rural communities, or if we're cutting Medicaid funding to every community in the U.S., rural communities, in my opinion, are going to be disproportionately hurt because rural economies rely more heavily on healthcare systems for employment, but there's also more likely to be a lack of access to healthcare resources in general in rural communities. And so once you take away a hospital, it could mean hours of a drive for someone to get to the closest emergency room or maternal care unit. And it just further strains rural communities.
What are you working on now?
I'm hoping to do some kind of analysis about which rural places might be most at risk of hospital closures given upcoming Medicaid cuts and Trump's budget reconciliation bill.
All right, that's data journalist Sarah Malott. She produces data visualizations, maps, graphics, and quantitative analysis at the Daily Yonder. And you can find Sarah's work online at dailyyonder.com. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard. Richmond novelist Wesley Brown just received some important recognition, and he stopped by to talk about that and his latest crime novel with Eastern Standard literary contributor Kevin Nance.
Well, first, Wes, I want to congratulate you on the Weatherford Award.
Thank you, Kevin.
I went back and did a little research, and I see that the list of winners of the Weatherford Award, which, by the way, recognizes both fiction and nonfiction and poetry books every year that shed light on the Appalachian experience. And some of the winners include Silas House, Nicole Brown, Robert Guype, who I know you know. I know you also know Silas. Karen Nelson, Barbara Kingsolver, Charles Fraser, you are up there with some big names. How does that feel?
Pretty great. I'm smart enough to know that because you win something they've won doesn't mean you're in their league. But you're in their sport, you know?
You're in the ballpark.
Yeah, you're in the ballpark. So that's part of what made winning a really big honor is I'm very aware of the Weatherford Award, and I'm very aware of who has come before me to the Weatherford Award.
And it's given by Berea College. When I interviewed you before on Kentucky Writers Roundtable on Media Lex, when the book first came out, mm-hmm. we talked about your relationship with the idea of genre. Mm-hmm. And you described yourself as a crime writer. And most of the books by the authors that I just mentioned, for example, who won the Weatherford Award over the years, I think we would generally call those literary novels mostly. And yours is a crime novel with, I think you said, literary. You want it to be popular, but you also want it to be good. It has literary style as well as genre conventions. Could you address that a little bit?
So in the market, I kind of gave away the end. They call it upmarket. It's when you write a genre book, but with literary qualities. And that's what I go for in my writing generally. My background was literary. I always kind of considered myself a literary writer. And then my first novel, Hillbilly Hustle, was more of a crime book. I don't know that I really planned it that way, but that was how it came out. And I realized that that's what I'm adept at. That's what I'm good at. I'm a lawyer. I was a criminal defense lawyer. I've been a prosecutor. I've been a public defender. I've kind of done all those things. So I've been around the system a lot. And I don't really have to research the characters too much or the system very much. I've been down in it for a long time. And so that's what I write. But I try to write it with the best qualities I'm able to write. One of the things that I was really pleased with was that it was able to win because it's the first crime novel to win the award. I think they've given it 55 years. And so that was really meaningful to me that to break through with the crime novel.
I guess we'd have to call him an anti-hero. He's a hero and an anti-hero, is named Burl Spoon, which a name that I love, and I think your readers love that name for some reason. He's kind of a marijuana mogul. He has a large marijuana growing outfit somewhere in Jackson County or mm-hmm. Estill County in that area of the world, and he is in a lot of ways a typical sort of gangster. You know, he's tough, he's mean, there's really nothing he won't do. But he's also, at the very same time, a loving father and grandfather, loves his family. He's estranged with one or two of them, but he still loves them. And you might even argue they love him. Well, certainly his granddaughter does. Mm-hmm. I guess it was important for you to have that sort of complexity where, you know, two diametrically opposed things can be true at the same time. He's a bad man. He's a good man.
Yeah, that's what I was going for. Burl Spoon first appears as a villain. I have two books, Hillbilly Hustle, and They All Fall the Same. They're both standalones. You don't have to read one or the other to enjoy them. But Burl Spoon was a lot of people's favorite character from Hillbilly Hustle. And I started it before Hillbilly Hustle came out, but I had a lot of what they call beta reads and my editor and stuff. And everybody said, I just really love Burl Spoon. And I had this idea for a book about a sort of a crime boss. And I already had Burl Spoon. And I made the decision, if you have a character that people love, why not just continue with that character? So that's what I did. And you've got to have people be three-dimensional. Everyone thinks they're right and good in a way, no matter how bad the world perceives them. Or at least I think it's rare that someone just outright decides they're pure evil. Burl doesn't really view the things he does as being evil. He views himself as in some ways sort of being altruistic, but he's ruthless and he's harsh. And I think that's more real. And I also think just from a entertainment perspective and a literary perspective, it's more interesting. A one-dimensional person is not interesting.
Well, when we talked before on that other occasion, we talked about this book in light of things like The Sopranos, Peaky Blinders, and I hadn't actually seen Peaky Blinders until very recently. I've sort of been binging it. And there's a moment in Peaky Blinders where Tommy Shelby says, the thing is, they're worse than we are.
Mm-hmm.
And so he justifies being a gangster by saying that the people he's taking advantage of, the people he goes to war with, they are worse than we are. And I think that can also be said of Burl. Burl gets into a life and death struggle with a rival gang, so to speak, also in the same part of the world. And I think you said it's like The Sopranos meets the Hatfields and McCoys. That's what it feels like. Can you talk about that?
It's funny. That phrase came from a reader review that I found online, and I was like, that's gold. And I've said it hundreds of times since then because it works, but that's kind of it. Is Clovis Begley is a heroin kingpin out of Madison County.
So he's worse than the marijuana.
And in Burl's mind, he comes out and says he doesn't think marijuana is harmful, but heroin is, whereas Clovis kind of thinks he's an okay guy, but he couldn't care less what happens to anybody. He thinks that the people who are harmed by the drugs he sells deserve what they get. And so in his mind, he's okay too, even though he's killing people. And that you see that mindset a lot. It's very rare that you see someone who commits serious crimes, financial crimes in particular, where they don't feel justified. Certainly people who commit crimes based on, you know, drug addiction, that sort of thing, they may come around at some point and understand that they've done wrong things. But a lot of the folks that you see that especially at high levels commit financial crimes, in their minds, whatever they're doing, they have a right to do. And it's wrong in the eyes of the law, but it's not wrong in their eyes.
Well, speaking of justified, I know that you are a big Elmore Leonard fan.
I am.
And he was, of course, the mind behind the show Justified, or at least it was based on his work. And it occurred to me that Burl and maybe Clovis, too, share some DNA with Mags Bennett from that show.
Yeah.
Who is the sort of this matriarchal gang mother figure who is really tough, and you don't mess with her because she'll poison you.
Oh, yeah. So the nice thing about Justified is not only did I watch the show, but I read the books as well. I grew up on Elmore Leonard. My mom used to go to author events. I grew up outside of Detroit. I didn't come to Kentucky until 1996. I went to the law school here at UK. And I lived, I don't know, 20, 25 miles from Elmore Leonard. And she would go to events and bring me signed Elmore Leonard books. So I was literally brought up on Elmore Leonard. And of course, I got a few of those. And then I just started, you know, I'd go to the library and check out his other books. I haven't read everything he's written, but I've read most of it. And
he's sort of a totemic figure for you, you might say.
He is. I will say this. He is a very spare writer. He leans heavily into genre. As much as I love Elmore Leonard, sometimes I want a little more. I would say authors like Ron Rash, who also won a Weatherford Award, who I very much admire, I try to kind of come in a little closer to him. I can't write like Ron Rash, don't get me wrong. But I sort of try to split the difference between a writer like Elmore Leonard and a writer like Ron Rash.
Well, I kind of feel like that's what separates a purely genre novel and a kind of higher grade literary thriller, which is what you do, in that the characters all have inner lives. Burrell is a very complex man, and he even thinks about, you know, judgment and God and, and sort of bigger issues. You know, it's surprising because, you know, we don't really see what's in Tony's head except when he goes to therapy. And I feel like if Burrell were going to a therapist, those conversations would be very interesting to hear. But he kind of has a therapist in the form of a mistress named Whitney, who there's a wonderful scene at the beginning of the book. And they have had a tryst. They're leaving, and a neighbor sees them, and she's, you know, saying, you know, you shouldn't be messing around. You've got a wife at home. And Whitney says to the lady who says this, people ain't perfect. And Lord knows that's true.
Well, and she also points out a very specific and legally precarious way that her neighbor is not perfect. And there's a little bit of a veiled threat there.
There's a threat there. Her neighbor is buying pills and letting her nephew.
She's getting her prescriptions, selling them to her nephew, who's then reselling them. So there's a point later in the book, and I don't want to give too much away, but a lot happens. And Burrell has some mental health struggles with some things that go on in the book. And you're right. Without giving away the whole book, she fills that role of doing her best to nurse him through the struggles that he's having and that sort of thing. One of the things that's interesting about blending genre and literary is in literary books, character development is really important. And it's really important to me, but when you're writing for genre, you have to keep the pace up. So it's a constant push-pull when you're writing for two audiences of, I've got to keep the pace going. I can't go too far into character development at any given time. I've got to keep it going. So you got to kind of bleed it out slowly and give the reader a little bit here, a little bit there, but keep the exciting elements going. Because I have a lot of little mini climaxes and small set pieces throughout the whole course of the book. And I try to keep suspense going and tension going all the time. And so it's a little bit of a balance between character development and feeding genre fans who are like, this is all well and good, but I want some action.
Well, when you said bleed it out slowly, you sounded suspiciously like Burrell there, which gave me a little chill down the back.
Hey, someone had to write that, man.
Well, Wes Brown, thank you so much for being with us today. Congratulations again on the Weatherford. We hope all our listeners will read the book. I can attest to the fact that it is a quick and exciting book to read. It reads like the wind. And yet, as you say, you get a lot of literary texture in the process of the destination. So thank you again for being with us today.
Thank you. And it just came out in paperback, by the way.
Ah!
So
can't forget that.
Yeah. And Kevin, thank you for talking again. It's always a pleasure.
All right.
Pat Banks is with us. Pat is an artist, an environmentalist, and director of the Kentucky River Keeper. It's a nonprofit on a mission to educate and advocate for the responsible stewardship of the Kentucky River watershed. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Pat.
Thank you for having me.
And first, that river. What's behind your fondness and care for the Kentucky River?
Well, everybody wants clean water. If you can get somebody to go down to their creek or to their river and actually experience it, it changes how you feel about it. You have a relationship to it then, and a responsibility. And so we want to have as many people have that kind of responsibility as we can.
I remember as a kid, there was a creek in front of our house. We lived in it. And it really did, as you say, it really did engender a respect for where that water came from and what we were doing in it and to it. Have we lost touch with that, do you think?
Very much so. Most people don't have access to the river. You can't just pull up to it and go jump in it. People say, oh, it's too dirty. It's like it's probably cleaner than it's been in a long time. And we do water testing as well. But you got to care about it.
Tell us about the teacher toolkit and a community resource that you developed with Roberta Hounshell. What does it teach?
The toolkit explores the geology, stewardship, history, the first people, the early settlers, the lockmasters. We're trying to tell the story through other historians' work and artwork. And, you know, even if it's a strict science class, the kids have to be able to make posters and things of what they're doing. So art is involved as well. So we started working on this, and the Kentucky River Authority was our first small grant. And then our Kentucky River Keeper Board got behind this, and we worked on this for several years. And the whole idea is to have kids experience, touch, feel, taste. We have recipes from native plants and walking across wet grass and feeling the dew.
Well, you invite school kids, grades 5 through 12, to do a lot of things, and you've had a number of programs going on lately. Tell us about those.
We're really excited about this. We had the opportunity to apply for a side-by-side grant with Arts for All Kentucky. Anyway, the idea is their grants are to incorporate art experiences with people who don't normally get some of that experience. And so we partnered with the Gallery on Main in Richmond, Richmond Parks, and Madison County Special Olympics. And so we have this wide range of students from fifth grade through high school, a couple a little bit older, and their parents. And we're doing a series of classes looking at animals from the watershed and plants. We have a discovery table that have furs and rocks and shells and turtle shells and wood and things that the kids can touch and explore. And then they do art, an art class, learning techniques and everything else, all in the context of our watershed. They also get to work with an individual artist one-on-one. That's where the side-by-side comes from.
When I was going through your materials, I came across something called the Kentucky River Water Trail. Tell us about that.
Well, that's been a passion because, well, you know, as an environmentalist, people talk about all of the bad stuff. You know, water. You know, don't pollute. Be careful of the mercury in the fish. I mean, there's all of this stuff you got to be aware of. And early on, when we were housed at the Center for Appalachian Studies, we wanted a positive message. Why do you want to save this water? Why do you want to be it? And we realized that getting people to the river was one way to really reach them, and the other stuff would start making sense. But it was a positive thing. And so getting students out on the river and in the watershed became a really important thing in eastern Kentucky all around. And then the idea started evolving about a water trail. And we worked with the National Park Service. But at the time, the Kentucky River Authority didn't want anyone on their property. And so it took a lot of work. And now the River Authority is, they're an umbrella for the Kentucky River Water Trail. The idea is building portages around the lock and dams, parks in all those 14 properties. Can you imagine putting your canoe in at Whitesburg, going all the way to Carrollton to the Ohio River?
Incredible.
Yeah.
And what brought them around anyway? Why did they
change? Just evolution. Working with the National Park Service, they thought, oh, this is a real thing. But they thought, oh, it's too much liability. We can't do it. But they worked through all of those processes because people have access to other rivers all over the country. And so as people became more educated, attitudes started changing. They started seeing, and there were other partners coming in. And now we have a whole bunch of new partners.
You mentioned it earlier, but there's nothing like a hands-on experience to get deep into a subject or into an issue. And I know that you organize river cleanup efforts, mm-hmm. which gets people down into the river and they're seeing the trash that has to be cleaned up. Do you have any of those going on this spring or summer?
We're doing road cleanups in the spring, And we're scheduling a lot of the water cleanups for the fall. One of our cleanups is going to be the kickoff for the Hellbender Festival, which is going to be a week-long celebration of the river.
Well, and tell people what a hellbender is.
That is a salamander, and it can get up to almost 2 feet. I mean, it's huge, and they hide under rocks, but they have to have clean water. It just seemed like the perfect example of what we've got to do. Anyway, we've got a couple road cleanups. We're working with partners in Lee County and in Hyde in particular. They've got a great city park, and we're also worried about the plastics that are getting into our bodies. People aren't realizing how the plastic breaks up into these small, small things, microscopic. It's in our birds. It's in our fish. It's in our bodies. And so there's some education that has to take place and thinking of, well, what can we do? How do we change this?
That's Pat Banks, artist, environmentalist, and director of the Kentucky Riverkeeper. It's a nonprofit on a mission to educate and advocate for the responsible stewardship of the Kentucky River watershed. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Yason Landero brings the sound of Colombian cumbia to Lexington on Sunday, May 10th at 7 p.m. at the Pam Miller Downtown Arts Center Black Box Theater in the latest presentation by Green Room Exchange, the unique local nonprofit that's bringing musical cultures of the world to Lexington. And with us now is Landero's road manager, Javier Mutis Visa. Welcome, Javier.
Hi. Hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here with all the audience.
Well, we're glad you could join us from Bogota. And first, for people who might be hearing Yason Landero's name for the first time, tell us about him. Who is he?
Well, Yason is a musician that was born in Los Montes de María, San Jacinto, Bolívar, Colombia. It's in the plains of the Caribbean coast in the state of Bolívar. Yason is an accordion player and singer who is the grandson of the legend Andrés Landero, the king of cumbia. So Yason is continue with the legacy of his grandfather, but he's also adding his personal touch. And the most important thing is that he's keeping alive this heritage and this tradition for the Colombian cultural legacy.
That's Javier Mutis Visa of OM Producciones, head of Yason Landero's May 10th performance in Lexington, presented by Green Room Exchange at the Pam Miller Downtown Arts Center Black Box Theater. And we thank you very much, and we'll see you soon.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced by WEKU and Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer. Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're on the WEKU, Apple, Spotify, and NPR apps. You can stream all of the interviews from this week's edition online at esweku.org. And while there, you can check out our contributors and their interview archives. Send your thoughts and suggestions to es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard.